The feast is o'er. Now brimming wine in lordly cup is seen to shine before each eager guest. And silence fills the crowded hall, as deep as when the herald's call thrills in the loyal breast.
Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, my co-host. And this is Joe Mason, my other co-host.
Hello. What's happening?
So I think we're going to jump in pretty unceremoniously into this one, because this is, you know, much less its own episode and more the follow-on to the previous episode, or the second half, rather. This is the explanation of how England found its way to the year 1066 and the Norman Conquest.
Yes, you had enough setup. You had, depending on how much editing we do, up to 3 hours of setup.
The scene has been shockingly set.
We spent so long talking about counties.
These wooden fucking trees are beautifully painted to the highest standard.
So let's just touch my model trains.
So let's meet the first of our protagonists.
All right, so where we left off, England was a country, basically. Yes. I mean, that's quite exciting. A whole place with a king and people and, like, land that's basically similar to the land that it is now.
It was exactly a modern nation state.
Yes.
Yes.
Just like the ones we see today.
Yeah, it that had was the sarcasm. Same flag as today.
That was sarcasm.
The same language, same accent.
Sarcasm.
Exactly.
Don't
people
say these
ate
things.
Bangers
people
and mash.
People don't know these things.
Peas, actually not
full
peas.
English. They loved it.
Yep.
Stop riffing! We need to meet Ethelred!
The full Anglo-Saxon-ish.
So, we spent most of the last
it's mostly
episode...
mostly turnips.
We spent most of the last part of the last episode in the 10th century, and now we're going to move on to the 11th century. So we're in England, the king is Ethelred, and you may have remembered from the past episode that Vikings were occasionally visiting England for various purposes, such as taking land and taking money and taking people and taking other valuables. And while they've been sort of temporarily staved off, they've been given, like, the bits of England we don't care about, like Yorkshire, they're kind of getting riled up again. And it's not great. And more Vikings are coming over from the Nordic parts of Europe. And Ethelred is not super stoked about having to deal with this. And so he's handing over, basically, when these Vikings show up or kick up a fuss, huge amounts of money. Basically protection money. So think of the Vikings as being a little bit like the mob, and Ethelred is a little bit like a local business owner who's got to pay just to keep things running.
Yeah, and this money that he is paying to Viking raiders to essentially say, essentially go-away money, gets called the Danegeld. And it's hugely, hugely extortionate for the Kingdom of England to keep paying this money. But the central problem with the Danegeld is that it provides an even more efficient way for Vikings to make money off of England than before. Because previously, you had to go and kill a bunch of monks. Now you just show up and somebody hands you a big bag of cash that you can then spend to build more ships.
Yep.
Can I sum up the voice? Hurdy-gurdy. Nice, nice early medieval kingship you have here. Shame if something were to happen to it.
Yeah, Ethelred has been known as Ethelred the Unready in the historical record. It should be said that the Unready is basically a sort of like middle slash old English epithet that means like ill-advised.
It means, it's unread.
Yeah, so Raiden is like to talk or like to advise. And Ethelred is quite funny because it means like noble advice. So it's actually a pun because it's like noble advice, the ill-advised.
Yeah.
It works Take better that, in old dickhead. English.
Yeah.
Let me tell ya.
Oh, sorry.
But
Lovin.
Oh, fuck yeah.
We're keeping that in.
Scampering
listen
noises.
To the last. Listen to the last. At the end of the last episode, if you don't understand this.
Oh, the Shabbat's going quite wet.
Yes. Just how we like it.
Yeah,
anyway,
boy.
Yeah.
We can't keep this in.
We can.
Can't.
Can.
No.
But I think Ethelred has been treated slightly poorly by the historical record, because he's not got a great choice set out for him, right? He can either pay the Danes, like, massive amounts of hush money, or he can try to, like, rally armies, which is stupidly expensive. He's, like, relying on all of his sort of regional, like, earls and noblemen to do that. He's gonna lose, like, loads of men who could be doing productive things like farming, And others, you know, the Vikings can basically just, like, retreat and come back the next year. And then that will, like, again, force him to confront the same decision again.
As much as it seems like a bad idea to pay them to leave him alone, he is left alone.
Exactly. Yeah.
And one of the interesting things about Ethelred is that in order to pay the Danegeld, he has to institute new taxes. And in order to collect those taxes, he needs to create a new type of royal official called a reeve. And each shire in England has a reeve who's responsible for collecting these taxes to pay the Danes to go away. And so you hear a lot about shire reeves, or as we call them today,
sheriffs
of Nottingham.
Yes. Well, among others.
Among others, yeah.
Yes. That's right. This is our Robin Hood episode. It was all a trick.
Yeehaw! I'm the sheriff of Nottingham.
Yep. So Ethelred is like extremely stressed out. Like I cannot emphasize enough how stressful of a position this guy is in. And he's got, like, a lot. I think he's probably, like, had to be a little bit suspicious towards, like, the rest of Europe, especially his immediate neighbors. And so he tries to, like, make some friends abroad. So he looks to Normandy, who are, like, right over the channel. And he's like, you guys are right over the channel. If I make friends with you guys, like, surely that's a good thing. And so he starts an alliance with Richard the First, the Duke of Normandy. And he says, like, please at least stop, like, harboring pirates who are going to attack me. At the very least, they form kind of, like, a tenuous bond. Ethelred kind of starts this tradition of, like, okay, we're at least going to try to, like, be friends with the guys right over the pond. Because they're at least, like, the lesser of 5,000 evils. And, in fact, when Ethelred's wife dies in 1002 A.D., Ethelred immediately marries the Duke's daughter, Emma. And he actually, like, renames her to his ex-wife's name, which is, like, a bit dodgy.
It's very Kanye West.
Yeah, a little bit. It is actually very Kanye West. And they have two sons, Alfred and Edward. And anyways, like, I think eventually Ethelred gets a bit tired of trying to sort of, like, be the nice guy, not piss anyone off. And he's like, okay, you know what we can do to fight off all these Vikings? We need, like, a bazillion boats. So he commissions, like, well, 300 boats, exactly, to tell the truth.
Slightly fewer than a bazillion.
300 boats, and, like, I think he really is one of the most unlucky guys in, like, the English historical record, because it goes incredibly awry. There's, like, a spat between two of the boatsmen, and one of them just, like, sort of fucks off and starts, like, sabotaging the defense mission that they're trying to launch against the Vikings. 80 of the 300 boats go in pursuit. No, I think 100 of the 300 boats go in pursuit, and 80 of them end up, like, dashing themselves upon the rocks of the south coast of England. And the guy who goes rogue is a guy named Wolfneth, who, if you live in London, you may have heard of a church called St. Mary Woolneth, and that is alleged to be a church that he sponsored himself. But yeah, Wolfneth manages to screw Ethelred over and basically completely cripple his entire, like, military defense strategy, which leads to 5 years of basically the Vikings claiming more and more and more land throughout, like, the south and east of England.
And when you see how poorly that went, maybe the option of paying them to leave you alone made a lot more sense, because this sort of early medieval warfare where you have, like, maybe a semi-complex state, but it is very fragile in the face of warfare. Actually, going out to fight is very high risk. You're relying on all these personal relationships not going wrong. So, and, like, the consequences of failing are 100 times worse than just not fighting at all.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's interesting that, like, the retrospective historiography of Ethelred is so relentlessly negative. Like, medieval historians of the time keep inventing anecdotes from early in his reign. They're like, oh yeah, this guy was always a wrong un. Like, there's a story about allegedly he, at his christening, he sort of had diarrhea all down St. Dunstan.
No!
Really?
Yes!
Oh, shit!
And there's constant comets in the sky. Like, the vibes are bad.
Oh, no.
Two-headed goat successor.
Yeah, it's classic medieval, like, when politics is going awry, people start finding weird sigils and signs.
He's not just a dude in a bad position. He, like, you know, fundamentally sucks.
And I think the political climate of England at the time is very febrile. It's very... People are... It's also around about the year 1000, and so people are already sort of primed to expect sort of divine intervention and divine retribution. And I think that the vibes are bad, and they are summed up very well by a sermon given by the Archbishop Wolfstone of York, who was often called Lupus, or the Wolf, a play on his name, which means wolf, in 1014. Because Wolfstone blamed the... He basically said that the escalating Viking invasions were a sign of the moral degradation of English society. And I'm going to get Joe, as a Yorkshireman, to read from this passage.
It is no wonder that there is mishap among us, because we know full well that now for many years men have too often not cared for what they did by word or deed. But this nation, as it may appear, has been very corrupt through manifold sins and through many misdeeds, through murder and through evil deeds, through avarice and through greed, through stealing and through robbery, through man-selling and through heathen vices, through betrayal and through frauds, through attacks on kinsmen and through manslaughter, through injury of men in holy orders and through adultery, through incest and various fornications, and also... That's not all. Far and wide, as we said before, more than should be are lost and perjured through the breaking of oaths and through violations of pledges and through various lies and non-observances of church feasts and fasts widely occurred time and again. And also, there are here in the land of God's adversaries, degenerate apostates and hostile persecutors of the church and entirely too many grim tyrants and widespread despisers of divine laws and Christian virtues, and foolish deriders everywhere in the nation, more often of those things than that the messengers of God command, and especially those things that always belong to God's law by right.
Yeah, it's fire and brimstone stuff.
It's definitely something that you could have heard in many Christian countries at basically any point in the past.
Who's that?
1500 years.
If it reminds you of Gildas,
yeah,
there's a reason why. Because they're doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So Ethelred is kind of continually having to decide, do I ask, like, all the guys in my kingdom to pay £1 million billion to make the Vikings go away, or £1 million billion to buy everyone a sword to try to fight the Vikings off? And it is a difficult decision. It's hard to say whether there's something that he could have done right, or whether he could have sort of staved off the inevitable, which is that, again, the Vikings rampage through the south of England. They conquer more and more land, and eventually they manage to basically seize all of England entirely until all of London is left, and then London itself surrenders to the Vikings as well. And Ethelred is forced to flee, and all of a sudden, a Viking named Swain Forkbeard seizes the throne.
It's very easy to be a sort of fantasy football league style king, fantasy king of England.
Yeah.
Say, well, you know, the problem with Ethelred the Unready is he always tried to walk it in. You know, and there were a lot of ludicrous displays. But I challenge you, dear listener, to do better. Why don't you become king of England?
All of our listeners play those map games.
Yeah, and
the Hearts of Iron map games. They definitely think they could.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that, for me, I think it's true that whatever Ethelred did, it didn't work. And I think, for me, the reason why it didn't work is because the Viking raids of the 11th century are essentially a test and then a failure of the capacity of the English state. Where essentially, in order to stave the Vikings off, the English state has to essentially start cannibalizing itself to extract more and more wealth from the population to pay these Vikings off or just to repel them. And England isn't able to sustain the political support for that. You know, bluntly, Svein Forkbeard conquering England is an enormous achievement for Svein Forkbeard. Svein
Forkbeard.
The fattest of all the Vikings.
Svein Forkbeard. Ethelred the
Unbreaded. He just got little bits of pulled pork.
Ethelred the Unbreaded.
I think we might. Yeah. Guys, do you think we might be a bit hungry?
How are we doing?
The oven is on.
Okay.
You might be able to hear it.
I can smell it. That's the problem. So, Svein Forkbeard conquering England is obviously a huge achievement for Svein Forkbeard, but I think that the important point is that for a lot of people in England, because remember, not everybody in England is English. Lots of people in England are very much identify as Scandinavians. You would not be able to have a Viking take over England in its entirety if there were not a significant number of people who were just content to go along with it, because it was becoming increasingly clear that resisting the Vikings was not sustainable.
So yeah, there's debate about, like, the extent to which Ethelred kind of stoked tensions between the native, English people and the Danes and the other Norse settlers, and, the extent to which this created, like, anger amongst the Norsemen, who then, like, were further sort of, motivated to take over Britain. I think most modern day scholars don't really put a lot of stock in that. I think they think that the Vikings wanted to take over Britain because it was, you know, it was a peach. It was a plum.
It's nice.
It's a nice place, Britain.
Same if something happened to it.
Exactly. You control Britain. You control out of the North Sea. You control out of, you know, shipping out of the north of Europe. It's also just like, it's a beautiful country. It's got the chalk cliffs of Dover. Yeah. It's got the fens.
Any more geographical locations you want to name?
It's got the lake. Just a lot of people think that the Vikings just wanted to take over England because they wanted to holiday in Windermere.
Oh. They wanted to check out the London Eye.
Exactly.
A hot tourist destination.
Exactly. They saw the Gherkin. They were like, that's novel architecture.
The old Gherkin.
Yeah, exactly.
I've never seen anything like this back in Sweden.
Exactly.
We don't even have towns. We all just live in farms. And we vote.
Anyway.
So, Svein Forkbeard is now King of England. He's now set up for a long and prosperous reign, right?
Not that outrageous turn, considering the fact that previously Ethelred was King of the Danes and the Anglo-Saxons. Yeah. And now you have a Danish King of the Anglo-Saxons and the Danes.
Exactly, and people were not, like, pleased with Ethelred towards the end of his reign. So, yeah, they kick him out to Normandy. He flees to Normandy, where his buddies, who he's kind of been, like, cozying up to, are like, fine, whatever, come over here.
Couch surfing Ethelred, I guess.
Yep. No, he was couch surfing. Yeah.
Ethelred is like, hey, Richard the First, can I crash?
Guys, my last job didn't go so well, but, like...
Yeah, exactly. I'll do the dishes, I'll cook for you, I can play the guitar.
Yeah. I know three songs.
Yep. Ethelred flees to Normandy, and now a Viking named Svein Forkbeard is King of England, which again is kind of nuts, and it's kind of nuts that the English nobles more or less seem to have accepted him. That being said, the period we're about to enter involves a lot of premature deaths, and Svein Forkbeard dies 40 days after assuming the throne. No one knows exactly why. Some say it was malicious, some say he fell off his horse.
Vaxxed.
Some say he was vaxxed.
So Ethelred thinks, okay, this charismatic Viking leader, Svein Forkbeard, is dead. Time for me to return gloriously to England as their once in future king. And they do let him back on the explicit condition that he's going to do a better job than last time, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, I know, it's so bad.
He shall rule them better than before.
It's going to be different than last time, I promise, though.
But I think, you know, again, this is like a moment where we see the sort of consensus building mechanisms of, like, this burgeoning English state, because he still has to have, like, a stamp from these, like, you know, 30-odd, like, noble guys who are willing to tell him, yeah, fine, you can come back.
Mm-hmm.
So it is like a formalization of the power that the nobility hold and the consensus that has to be reached. But he does come back.
Yeah. So, problem solved, right? Ethelred forever, baby.
Yeah. I'm gonna live forever.
Yeah, except what happens almost immediately is that Svein Forkbeard's son, Knut, arrives on the scene. And he also wants to take over England. And then Ethelred dies.
Yeah.
Vax. Ethelred dies untimely, and, like, that creates a political opportunity for Canute.
Yes. So Canute invades England. So in the wake of Æthelstan's death, the Witan, the sort of the assembly of great nobles of Anglo-Saxon England who choose the next king, they elect Canute as the king. But the city of London, who are still a very well-organized political community at this point, revolt, instead choosing Æthelstan's son Edmund, who later gets the name Edmund Ironside for just generally being cool.
And hard as shit.
Yeah. So Edmund leads an absolutely ferocious resistance to Danish rule for a few months, which forces Canute to essentially agree to partition the kingdom, granting Edmund Wessex and the rest of the kingdom to Canute, essentially reformalizing that same stupid line from the days of Alfred the Great. But so England has been partitioned again, except a few months later, Edmund dies, and Canute inherits Wessex.
Vaxxed.
And Æthelstan's sons are sent back to exile in Normandy, where they will remain for a while.
I think it's tragic that we don't have the sort of Eastern Roman Empire sort of tradition of sudden deaths. Wherein it truly is like a clear metaphor for he was poisoned.
Yeah.
Like, it's a less sophisticated political culture, so instead guys just die.
Oh, not to get into this, we will get into some Byzantine assassinations and emperor offings in the next episode. It's going to be very fun.
And you'll see how much more slick they were with it.
Yeah. Well, also they were just like, yeah, we fucking killed him, what are you going to do?
I mean, some of these dudes probably just fell into a toilet.
Well, that's one of the things that, like, in Wolf Hall, they're kind of, like, quite clear about, is, like, they get the fancy French executioner to kill Anne Boleyn, but all of the English people are like, no, mate. If you're gonna execute me, do it the good old-fashioned way.
Yeah.
With an axe.
Chop my head off badly.
I don't
badly.
Care how many strikes it takes, like...
I'm a fucking Englishman. I'm born in Stoke, live in Stoke, die in Stoke.
Yep. So this is pretty fucking unprecedented, because we get a Viking on the throne of England, one who does not die under mysterious circumstances immediately. And this is an odd footnote from English history that I think a lot of people don't know about, which is that for quite a few years, we just had a Viking king.
Yeah.
And it seems to have worked out, like, kind of well.
And when we say a Viking king, I think we need to emphasize a couple of things, like, he is a Christian. He was baptized. He is, you know, and he makes a great show of being a model Christian king. Like, he goes on pilgrimage to Rome in 1027. And he's also performatively conciliatory to the House of Wessex.
This is the late Viking era. They've already scared off all the weirdos to Iceland and Greenland.
These guys are trying to settle down and start a family.
Everyone who can be normal is, like, hanging around now.
Can we just be, like, normal Europeans, please, with worse weather? But he literally goes so far as to present Edmund Ironside's tomb with a giant, like, an elaborate woven cloak decorated with peacocks.
Oh, that's quite sweet.
I know, it's quite nice. But he's not... whether or not he's, like, this iron-fisted kind of Viking warlord is a bit more ambiguous. Like, he does immediately after becoming king levy a tax of over £12,000 on England as a whole. Essentially to pay all the Viking armies to just fuck off.
Because he has
once
these...
and for all.
He sort of has the exact same problem.
Yeah. But... well, it's the classic poachers-turned-gamekeepers problem.
Yeah, like, all these guys who got used to getting fat off either being paid to leave or raiding are now like, well, we run this place.
Yeah.
Where do we get the money from?
The people. Just taxes. Yeah. There's a way. It's automated extraction.
I've often compared taxes to Viking raids.
All right, Mr. Libertarian.
It must be defended against with violence. Yeah. But I think, like, what's interesting is we get some kind of endearing, like, legacy out of Canute. Mm. Like, he is not someone who, like, unlike Ethelred, who is an English guy, who's, like, elected by the English people, this sort of, you know, you could say Viking interloper, like, we kind of get some great stories about him. I mean, I love the one of King Canute and the Tide. This is, like, one that I think is well-known in England, but not elsewhere.
I was going to Canute and saying, "Oh, Canute, my fly's undone. Oh, Canute, can you do my shoelaces? My peasants are dirty. Can you do something about this as king?"
you know, my wife's being a bit of a bitch.
He's like, right,
don't
come
make
on.
Turnips the way that I want.
Turnips don't taste as good as they do when I was a kid.
Yeah, exactly.
They changed turnips.
Knut, they canceled my favorite Saturday morning mummer's show.
My favorite Saturday morning puppet show. Because of woke.
And Knut marches his men down to the seashore, basically. And he apparently commands them to bring his throne down to the beach. And he has them set his throne on the beach, and he sits upon it, and he, like, commands the tide not to rise anymore. And believe it or not, the tide continues to rise.
Yeah.
And this is, like, sometimes misconstrued as an example of, like, extreme sort of arrogance, but actually, like, the metaphor of this story is, like, the king can only do so much. The king is not all-powerful.
And he's making this point in the most petty way possible.
Yeah.
Where everybody... I believe this happened on some level. Because I love the idea of him, like, forcing everybody to go through this thing. That everybody understands the point he's making long before the event happens. But they have to spend an entire day doing this.
And he got what he deserves. Which means nowadays everyone says, get a load of this idiot.
Yeah.
He thought he could stop the tide coming in.
It's like, no, you fucking morons. The other thing that I think is interesting about him is that he does marry Athelstan's wife.
Yeah,
he
steals his
wife after his death.
I mean, I think this is
already had a wife.
Yeah, so this is true, and I mean, this is where the kind of like early Christianization of the Vikings like begins to show itself as like a separate phase.
All Mormons Christians?
Well, yeah, exactly. Because I think, like, it's clear to Knut that, like, marrying the old king's wife is a great way to, like, legitimize himself as the new king. And I think it's clear to Emma, to be fair, slash as Ethelred had rechristened her after his ex-wife, Elfgifu. But it's clear to this woman,
everybody in this story is mentally ill.
And yeah, this is definitely the story of a lot of people who have autism.
It's a lot of very normal guys.
Yeah. But
anywhere.
I think Emma also knows that, like, this is a good way for her and maybe even her sons, who she's had by Ethelred, to, like, not die under suspicious circumstances, as loads of people in this story have.
Yes, yeah, so one of the things, we talked about how Knut is being very conciliatory to the sort of the family of Edmund Ironside. One of the things that he does do is that he sends Edmund Ironside's sons to the King of Sweden with a sort of note saying, please kill these guys. Dispose of them. But the interesting thing is that the King of Sweden doesn't do that. He's just like, oh, you can go to Hungary. So they essentially, a chunk of the House of Wessex decamps to a castle in Hungary for the next couple of decades.
A fate worse than death.
Mm-hmm.
Think of all the goulash they had to eat.
Oh, no.
And this was before the Turks, though, so nobody
yeah,
has
no,
paprika.
No paprika yet.
Oh, my God, no.
Imagine Hungarian
paprika.
Cooking without paprika.
Oh, fucking hell. Yeah, no, it's messed up, and yeah, he marries Emma. He already has a wife. That wife is not dead. He just kind of sidelines her, and it's apparently, like, fine. Because people are still working out, I think, at this point, like, what the church is.
Has clerical celibacy happened yet?
Let's call clerical celibacy is starting to happen. The reform movement is gaining pace in the church on the continent, but has not really reached Britain yet.
Presumably in part because of stuff like this.
Yeah. Well, it certainly hasn't reached fucking Scandinavia, where they've been doing polygamy for, you know, 500 years, and they're just like, well, I don't understand why Jesus didn't say anything about that.
Exactly.
Right. But yeah, so one of the interesting things about Knut, though, is that, yes, he's this kind of ambiguous, is he a little bit English, is he a little bit Viking, is he a little bit Christian, he's all of these things. And English sources don't really criticize him. They seem to think that he was pretty chill. What's interesting, though, is that Danish sources are quite different. So Ottar the Black, in a skaldic celebration of the sort of the his conquest of England, says that you smote the race of Edgar in that raid. The deep dike flowed over the bodies of the Northumbrians. Edmund's noble offspring met with deadly wounds. They could not defend their strongholds when you attacked. So it's like he's doing classic Viking shit of, like, killing people's families and taking their strongholds and so on. So it's clearly, there's clearly an audience in the Scandinavian community that still valorizes that kind of behavior, even though this guy is very clearly wants to be seen as a legitimate English king and wants to be seen as a rightful Christian king.
He's sort of like code-switching between two friends.
No, he is.
That's a really good way
he's
of
like,
putting
okay,
it.
He's like, okay, I can't make those jokes in front of my girlfriend's friends.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, mate, like, I'm bringing my new girlfriend tonight. It's like, please, everyone, like, act cool.
Yeah. He's going to Scandinavia and putting on the mascara and dyeing the hair black.
Yeah. So he mostly keeps the kind of infrastructure of English government intact. But he does make one major change that is important to the story of 1066, which is that he replaces the role of the county earldoman, who is like the guy who is in charge of managing a county on behalf of the king, with jarls, or as the English call them,
earls.
Earls, who are responsible for the administration and defense of these huge provinces that broadly map onto the old 9th century kingdoms of Wessex, Northumbria, Mercia, and East Anglia.
Yeah, and I think another interesting thing that will put Cnut in contrast to future people with designs on England is that he doesn't, like, completely replace the nobility or, like, the legal systems or the court systems or anything. In fact, a lot of the nobility stay English, mm-hmm. although Cnut does appoint a sort of lot of sort of, like, newly made men from amongst, like, the, I don't know, B-lists, I guess, of the English nobility.
Well, most of the A-list died in the war with Edmund Ironside, so there is a sort of necessity for that.
Yeah, so you have this interesting thing where, like, a lot of English guys who were kind of, like, secondary players before, like, suddenly come to the front. And I think you do have to wonder as well, like, are some of these guys being promoted because maybe they were helpful to Cnut? Maybe they played some role in Edmund Ironside dying? I don't know. Nobody knows. This was 1,000 years ago.
They got local connections, you know, they know how things were run.
Yeah,
they got, like, ears on the streets. And so you do have, like, a whole sort of nouveau riche, I would say, that form amongst the men of England. And one of the big players who will play a pretty massive role in the rest of this episode is a man named Godwin. He's a little bit mysterious in that, like, we don't know exactly where he comes from or who he is. So he is super nouveau riche. Like, this is a guy who, like, drives the most expensive Range Rover. He has, like, 3 Rolex watches and, like, an XL Bully.
His Range Rover does have working class on the number plate.
Yeah, exactly. No, he is, like, true Essex geezer. Yeah. Like, oh,
he's loads of money.
And, like, look, he is also, like, he is from, like, a piece of shit background, allegedly, because one of the rumors about who his father is that his father is Wulfneth, who betrayed King Ethelred at, in Kent, when they were trying to stave off the Vikings. And so there is definitely, like, a chance, a pretty good chance, I think, that not only does he come from, like, this extremely morally questionable background, but that he's got, like, a grudge against the sort of House of Wessex, against the, you know, old English nobility, because they were the ones that were like, what the fuck, Wulfneth, you can't do that, and chased him down and stripped him of his properties. And so maybe he has, like, he's someone who's starting off with a bit of a grudge.
He comes across as this very hard scrabble, and as we'll see, very brutal guy.
I was gonna say he's a man with a dream.
Yes.
Which is the most dangerous thing of all.
Yeah. So within a few years of Cnut assuming the throne, he is made the Earl of Wessex. He's the first Englishman to become one of these earls after they're created. Most of them are given out to various sort of Viking warlords who've been involved in either in the original kind of conquests pre-Cnut or in Cnut's war with Edmund. And he ends up actually marrying Githa, who is a Danish noblewoman who's related closely to Cnut's family. Now, Godwin wasn't Cnut's only English earl, so by the 1020s, Mercia is ruled by Leofric, who's the son of the old earldoman of the Hwicca under... Sorry, I had to really enunciate that. The Hwicca under Ethelred. But Godwin is clearly the number two. He is the Ned Stark to Cnut's Robert Baratheon. So Cnut is... Also, the other thing to understand about him is that he's enormously ambitious in European politics. So 2 years after conquering England, he succeeds his brother Harald as the king of Denmark. And then in 1028, he launches an invasion of Norway, deposing the king, the Norwegian king Olaf, and bringing pretty much all of the North Sea suddenly under his dominion, which leads to a political community that is often referred to as...
the North Sea Empire. And I think, like, you cannot underestimate how much of a peach this situation is. Because if you control the North Sea, I mean, we already have, like, seen how, like, history has borne out the importance of the Netherlands and, like, northern Germany, the whole Hanseatic area, the lowlands in general, the north of France is, like, economically and geographically important areas. So if you control this, like, crucial North Sea channel, like, mate, you're fucking minted. Like, you're made. You're a made man.
You've got cod for days.
Yeah. Oh, you got cod for fucking months.
Yeah. But it's important. I think it's important to note, because we've been talking, in, especially in the previous episode, about, like, how important the creation of a unitary kingdom of England is. It's important to note that this is very much a personal union of these three kingdoms. He doesn't try and, like, create some unified political empire, which is what I think people imagine when they think of a North Sea empire. This is a patchwork of kingdoms that he can't even rule directly from England. So he dispatches various sons to rule Norway and Denmark.
I think he sends his first wife to Norway. Yeah. He's like, honey, like...
Well, he sends his first wife and his, like, and his fail son.
Yeah.
to Norway, and they don't do a very good job. And then he sends the son he actually likes to go to Denmark.
He's like a guy in an infomercial being like, how do I hold all these crowns? And then dropping out his fingers. Yeah.
Well, speaking of crowns dropping out of his fingers, despite being a pretty titanic sea-bestriding figure who is incredibly important in European politics, Canute dies in November 1034.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, that's true.
Shit.
And also, without a clear reason for his death?
Facts.
Awkward.
I mean, at least he got, like, 20 years.
Never in danger, quailed our fathers, free and undaunted, they sought our renown.
So, Canute had quite unhelpfully, for England's political stability, sired two healthy adult sons by two different women.
I never thought polygamy would come back to bite me in the ass.
Said every Ottoman sultan.
Well, crucially, like, he has a son who's, like, eligible heir, but he sent that son to Norway.
Yeah.
And so, it's like, you need to sort out Norway.
So there are two sons that we need to keep track of, right? Because they're sons by two different women. So at some point prior to becoming king, Canute had a son by an English woman by the name of Elfgifu called Harold Harefoot. Then, with Emma of Normandy, they had another son, Harthacnut.
Not to mention, like, the few sons that, like, Emma's got kicking about from her first marriage with Ethelred.
Oh, yeah, they're still in Normandy.
They're like, ooh, can we come back to England soon?
Well, we'll get to them in a second.
Might maybe be, mine?
My independent... you know, work hasn't really worked out.
Exactly.
Is there a spot in the company for
you? Exactly.
So there are two competing candidates to be Canute's heir for the kingdom of the kingdoms of England, Norway, and Denmark. And so once again, as happens when there's a succession crisis in England, the Witan was convened in Oxford, and the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle basically tells us, uncharacteristically for the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, does tell us what the kind of political split was. So Godwin and Emma were way behind Harthacnut, but Harold Harefoot was supported by the men of the North and Earl Leofric of Mercia, and also the men of London.
Too right.
Yeah, once Canute dies, we have two of his sons who both have, like, pretty decent claims, even especially because the guy who's got the better claim is away dealing with stuff in Norway, and so he can't actually be there to rule. So there's a lot of tension regarding that. And meanwhile, we also have Emma of Normandy's two other sons, Edward and Alfred, who have been kicking about in Normandy and are kind of waiting for their opportunity to come back. And they think, oh, maybe, you know, it's time for, like, us to come back. You know, we've had a Viking king for 20 years, but, like, that's nothing compared to how long Wessex was in charge.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's time for us to come back. So under somewhat mysterious circumstances, both of them come back to England.
In 1036.
In 1036, only for Alfred to get murdered.
Yeah, so he arrived with a bodyguard of Norman mercenaries who are... And again, the reason why he arrives, it's kind of... It's a bit ambiguous. Why does Alfred try and come... And why do Alfred and Edward try and come to England?
Some say the English were just, like, gagging for them to come back. And were like, please come rule us, daddy. Some people say, oh, this was, like, a bit of a trap in the first place. Which is a theory that is somewhat substantiated, again, by the fact that Alfred immediately is set upon by Godwin's men.
Yes.
And is... basically abducted and not murdered, but dies under quite brutal circumstances after being tortured in captivity.
Vax.
No, this is on this circumstances. We actually do have a pretty good explanation.
Don't they like gouge out his eyes or something really brutal?
They gouge out basically all the men in Alfred's kind of company are slaughtered. Oh yeah, I've got a poem that I'm not going to read, but does go into excruciating detail. It says, some were sold for cash, some cut down cruelly, some put in fetters, some were blinded, some hamstrung, and some of them scalped. No bloodier deed was ever done in this land, not since the Danes came and made peace here. So they don't scalp Alfred. What they do instead is they gouge out his eyes and send him to live in a monastery in Ely, where he almost immediately dies.
Oh, that's nice.
They gouge out his eyes with hot pokers, yes. By the way. And the other son of... Ethelred and Emma, by the way, Edward basically immediately flees.
Yeah. I wonder why.
And so I think, like...
for unknown reasons.
He steps foot in England, immediately men butcher his friends and blind his brother. He's like, you know what? Peace out. I'm going back.
Yeah, and so I think, like, for me, the main takeaway here is, I mean, the fact that Godwin is doing this shows the fact that he is... allied himself, I would say, quite firmly with, like, Knut and Knut's successors.
He's a real striver. He wants it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's not really, like, tied to, like, oh, this is my family or these are my countrymen. And he is clearly a guy with quite a bit of sway in the whole king-making process. So he's perfectly happy to intervene to decide who's got the power and who does not. Yeah. So, yeah, and I think, like, at this point in the story for me, when I was reading this, this is when, like, Godwin starts to take shape for me as, like, a guy who's a complete bastard and is both, like, willing to do anything sort of for power and for clout, but is also regarded as, like, a complete piece of shit, I think, by, like, the rest of the world. And he's such an interesting guy for this, I think. I mean, one of my favorite, quite apocryphal, like, legends about him is, like, wow, this whole succession crisis between these two sons is going on.
Yeah, because they keep beefing with each other and trading thrones.
Yeah, exactly.
It's truly not worth dealing into the bloody details.
Yeah, but anyways, like, one of them dies. The guy who, like, Godwin has been working on behalf of and has blinded Alfred on behalf of. And the new one who takes the throne, like, Godwin sort of grovels to him and is like, actually, I'm going to be on your side now. And apparently he sends Godwin to dig up the rotting corpse of the first son from Westminster Abbey and behead it and throw it into the fens by the River Thames. So he sends Godwin basically to, like, do the dirty work with his own hands, as if he's saying, like, look what you've done.
Desecrate the corpse of his friend.
Yeah.
Godwin's switching between the most horrible deeds imaginable in any culture to, I'm just a little guy. And it's my birthday.
Yeah. The important point is that by 1042, both Harold Harefoot and Hartha Knut have died, some under suspicious circumstances. Let's be honest, both under suspicious circumstances. And the great men of England... sort of with not... So the line of Canute is basically done, and so the great men of England turn south to the surviving son of Ethelred the Unready and invite him to return to England. And this is the man that will later become known as Edward the Confessor.
And the funny thing is that Godwin, despite being a bastard who spent, like, the past 20 years supporting various Vikings over, like, his own countrymen, seems to support Edward coming back to England from Normandy and assuming the throne. And why exactly this is, I think, is a little bit of an unknown. I think one could imagine maybe, you know, Godwin just being, like, quite a powerful guy and possibly seeing... this sort of, like, alienated sort of guy who's spent a lot of time across the pond is maybe being someone who he can exert some influence over, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, Edward has no power base. When he arrives in England, he has no power base in English politics. And so, actually, if you're Godwin, having essentially a cipher on the English throne who nevertheless has this kind of this dynastic legitimacy would be quite a good idea.
Yeah, exactly. And we do see, like, basically right off the bat, like, Edward knows he has to play ball with Godwin, despite the fact that I think he knows, you know, obviously, like, the relationship between them is quite acrimonious, you know, where there's reason for some tension between them in the first place, because Godwin, like, probably killed Edward's brother, never really suffered any consequences for that. But yeah, he is just like a guy that Edward just has to work with, you know? I think, like, in any co-worker situation, they're basically stuck together and they have to sort of play ball with each other until something gives.
It's hard to challenge a guy when he keeps talking about getting his blinding stick out.
Yeah, exactly.
I can show you my blinding stick and tell you about the last time I used it.
Oh, your brother loved the blinding stick.
There's a really nice monastery this time of year. Maybe you'd like to visit.
Yeah. And I think maybe, like, some of the fallout from this is the fact that Edward goes down in history as being, like, a bit of a wet blanket, like, kind of a lame guy. He definitely has, like, I'd say he's not seen as being quite as, like, stupid as Ethelred is, but he is definitely seen as being, like, quite ineffectual.
Or alternatively, as a sort of blind religious zealot. That's
yeah.
The other kind of...
Who, like, loves God too much to, like, govern his kingdom. People are like, you know, can you pass a law? And he's like, no, I'm praying.
So I have to go to church.
Yeah.
But those are just ways of explaining the hard realpolitik of the situation. This guy's been in Normandy. He spent his entire adult life there. He doesn't really know anything about England or English politics and how much English politics has changed since he left. Almost 20 years ago.
In a way, religion is probably what he had most in common with the guys back in England.
Absolutely.
It's the one constant.
Yeah, and I think he does, you know, he does make a lot of smart choices because he has these pre-existing connections in Normandy. And so he tries to, you know, continue to, like, shore up his support in Normandy and amongst the Normans and maintain those alliances while dealing with the, you know, perfidious Englishmen at home.
This will have no consequences.
Yep. So yeah, but meanwhile, like, Godwin is very much working, he's working pretty hard at sort of, you know, getting his fingers in basically every single pie.
He's scheming, he's got fires in the iron.
Yeah.
You know, he's rubbing
exactly.
His hands together.
Yeah.
There's a big montage of him stalking around the palace.
Traipsing. Muttering.
Yeah.
So he marries, Godwin marries his, daughter Edith to Edward, so now his daughter is the king's wife, so that's, again, pretty big move,
And also, any children that come of that marriage will be the unification of his family, which is, again, this kind of, like, nobody, like, lesser noble family from, like, the arse end of Wessex will now be part of the royal line moving forward.
Yeah.
At least that's the idea.
No, exactly. And it's, this is, like, for me, a really interesting sort of, like, turning point, because you could easily see how this would look like, you know, for both parties, for Edward and Godwin. This is like, oh, we could finally put all of this quarreling and, like, quibbling and murder behind us, because if Godwin's daughter and Edward have a kid, then, like, that kid will be Godwin's grandkid and will probably assume the throne if it's a son, and then Godwin will be, like, a made man for life. Edward will have an heir. It will all be completely legitimate and above board. And obviously, what does the one thing that the marriage does not do is produce any children whatsoever.
Yes. So there's a lot of theories about this. The sort of the English historiography after this is just like, well, he was such a devout man, he didn't want to have sex with a woman who was, like, much younger than him.
Young enough to be his daughter.
Yes.
Specifically. Although she was 25.
Yeah.
So, and he was, like, 45.
It's a very Leo
so
DiCaprio kind of relationship.
Yeah, but it's not, like,
it's not,
you know,
May, December, but it's, like, I don't know, May, September.
Yeah. You know, it's something that would, like, raise eyebrows now, but, like, in the context of medieval court politics, he would not have, you know,
it
would
also
not be,
like,
expected that, like, a 25-year-old woman and a 45-year-old man would be such a shocking matchup that he would be like, I can't, I just
also,
can't.
We're going to see much more
she's too nubile.
We're going to see much more problematic age gaps
later
in the story.
Exactly. And a lot of, I think, the reason why we don't know is because Edith herself sort of after the fact, does a lot of sort of historiographizing and says, like, oh, this was why he was so pious. Which obviously, you know, if my marriage failed to produce a child, I would also be like, oh, we were too pious.
Yeah bro, I've actually been chased this whole time.
Yeah. It's not that we were going at it every night. And just like, one of us, clearly something wasn't working out with at least one of us.
Yeah, I mean,
Edith. We were just too chased.
Edith is a really interesting character in all this, because she is sort of, she doesn't really get to kind of play a role in the story in media res. But after the fact, she does kind of get to do a little bit of kind of massaging the historical narrative. And yeah, if you were the queen who failed to produce any legit or any heirs at all, that is a huge political problem. But it's also for you a great kind of shame and embarrassment, potentially. When in fact, the reality is that some people just can't have kids.
Exactly.
It's just a medical reality. Yeah. He probably wasn't too fucking pious to ever bed this nubile young maiden, and he probably just, like, for whatever reason, they didn't have children.
Yeah, and I mean, it should also, I think, be said that, like, the sources that Edith is sort of, you know, leaving behind happen after the Norman Conquest. So I think knowing, like, what the fallout was from this union not producing any kids, yeah, you would want a good reason.
But what it does do is, I think it does probably make it, I don't know if it necessarily drives a wedge between between Godwin and Edward, but it certainly means that their kind of the mutual benefit that their alliance has to one another starts to fray.
The maneuver has failed.
Yes, essentially, exactly. And so suddenly, what you start to see in the late, you know, 1040s into the 1050s is increasing levels of tension between the nominal authority of the king and the kind of the real power of the throne, which is the Earldom of Wessex.
Godwin's walking around talking about the hot irons again.
No, definitely. And Edward is sort of, you know, as well continuing to, like, try to play to both sides. He's, like, calling in political favors. He's kind of trying to cozy up to everyone. He's putting out a lot of fires. And he is trying to, I would say, increase Norman influence in England, because he brings over, like, loads of Norman dignitaries. I think he, like, promises some land to some of them. He brings over one particular guy who's, like, traveling through the south of England. And he does manage to, like, strong arm some, like, Normans and some of his own allies in and replace some of, like, Knut's made men, Knut's sort of, you know, nouveau riche guys with, you know, his own sort of friendly people.
And which obviously makes him less popular with those people again.
Well, yeah, exactly. And Godwin, obviously, in particular, does not love this. And so in the early 1050s, actually, there's a huge incident in Dover, in Wessex, so part of, like, Godwin's land, where a visiting Norman noble and his men show up to, you know, stay the night, and basically all of the townspeople of Dover just, like, riot and start, like, knocking Norman heads together. People die. It turns into a huge conflict. And Edward calls upon Godwin to punish the town of Dover in what is the accepted way to do this back in the time, which is basically just to, like, completely raise the town and just basically send, you know, a message that they won't forget by sending Godwin's men and just committing, like, extreme violence to the townspeople.
And Godwin says, get fucked,
basically. Yeah, which, you know, you can see how, like, that kind of collective responsibility tactic seems utterly draconian to us now, but this is something that Godwin himself would have participated in when it came to other people's towns.
Yes.
And, you know, people,
he was not above this.
Yeah, exactly.
He was not the kind of guy who blanched tremendous and indiscriminate violence.
No, yeah, this wasn't a, like, oh, I don't agree with your methods. This was a, you know, fuck you, I don't wanna.
Yeah.
And publicly refusing such an order sends a big statement.
Yeah.
You know, like, it means something to have be told and say no.
Yeah, and so what happens is that Godwin is accused of being a traitor to the king, and is given, and he and his sons are essentially declared outlaws and given 5 days to flee the country. And poor Queen Edith, by the way, just gets sent to a convent.
Yeah, and things immediately escalate, and it kind of looks like they're both moving towards war, Godwin and Edward, and Godwin is kind of trying to, like, rally support. And and it seems like maybe Godwin is counting on the other earls of England to stand behind him. But they don't. They rally behind Edward instead. And allegedly, you know, heavy grain of salt here, Edward sends a message to Godwin and says, "You can be pardoned if I can see my brother Alfred again."
Which is great. But I think it also, that moment also is an incredibly instructive moment, because it shows that the other earls of England, and I think the Earl of Mercia in particular, they have also recognized that the Godwins are a threat to their own political kind of autonomy. And so actually Godwin getting taken down a peg serves them quite well. I think it's important to remember there are basically three poles of English politics at this point, which is the Godwinsons, Edward, and then just every other earl. Godwin and his sons are declared outlaws, and they're given 5 days to flee the country. Poor Edith, the queen, gets ditched to a convent, which, to be honest, she's probably like, you know what, I need the space. All you people are mental. Edith is a really nice character. She's, like, very well-read, very sophisticated woman, and she's dealing with all these psychos. But anyway, so, obviously, Godwin and his sons do not accept this, and they immediately start planning their grand return. So Godwin sends his son Harold to Ireland to start raising an army, while Godwin himself sort of holes up in Flanders, which is where, as we will see, where Godwinsons go when the going gets tough.
When the going gets tough, the Godwinsons get going to Flanders.
To get some Stroopwafel. And so in 1052, they return at the head of a war fleet, and the local burghers and peasants of the south coast of England basically rally to him and say, "Well, we're not going to fight you. You're our earl. Welcome back." And in a humiliating climb down, Edward allows Godwin to return. And this has essentially, in a moment, dissipated any kind of authority that Edward previously had to rule as anything other than a cipher for the powerful families of England and a mediator in English politics. And Godwin is immediately restored to the Earldom of Wessex, and not only that, but over the following decade, his family start extending their power over the country. So when Earl Seward of Northumbria dies in 1053, Godwin's son Tostig is appointed his replacement. And within a few years, only Mercia itself was not ruled by a member of the Godwin family. However, there's another one of these. As is the case in English politics, as soon as Godwin reaches the apex of his power, he dies in a public event at Edward's side. And his son Harold is appointed Earl of Wessex in his place.
How old is he when that happens? Like, just out of, you know...
He's, like, late middle age. I mean, he's, like, grizzled.
You know, like, guys die.
Yeah, we basically don't know, like, anything about his early life. So.
If there's anybody...
He's got, like, loads of kids at this point, yeah. So...
If there's anybody in this story who wouldn't have gotten the vaccine, it is Godwin of Wessex.
Coughing on everyone. In public.
And this is another really apocryphal legend that I quite like, but one of the legends about how Godwin dies says that he and Edward were, like, once again rehashing the whole argument about Alfred being killed and whether or not Godwin was the one behind that. And allegedly, and this is, by the way, like a 12th century account that is written way after Godwin is dead, but there is an account that says that Godwin tries to clear his name by holding up a piece of bread and saying, "May this crust..." Wait, no, you read this.
Yeah.
Okay.
It has to be Joe.
Right. "May this crust, which I hold in my hand, pass through my throat and leave me unharmed to show that I was guiltless of treason towards you and that I was innocent of your brother's death. The work says he then swallowed the crust, but it stuck in his throat and killed him." So presumably when he said that, went,
watch this, dickhead.
I bet I can get this entire French bread in my mouth in once. Yeah. Harold, so no.
but I can eat this comically oversized sandwich in one bite like Scooby-Doo.
Power is increasingly kind of consolidated within their clan. And so Edward the Confessor essentially calls a Hail Mary. And he, because he knows that somewhere out there in Europe, maybe the sons of Edmund Ironside, who had been sent away by Canute decades ago, somewhere the sons of Edmund Ironside might still be living in Europe. Oh yeah, he brings back, I should have said, he lets Edith out of the nunnery. After the Godwinsons get back, which, you know, gun on him, I guess.
It's nice of him, I suppose, yeah. I mean, he doesn't really have much choice in the matter. No. Sorry, I've got your daughter locked up.
I know you get to run the country on my behalf.
Can she come back? Okay, I guess, yeah.
But yeah, so in 1054, Edward the Confessor sends Eldred, the Bishop of Worcester, on a secret mission to go and basically see if he can retrieve the sons of Edmund Ironside, who, remember, had been sent away by Canute after he took the throne, and had actually been living under the protection of the Hungarian king in Reka Castle.
It's quite impressive, you know, like a bishop sneaking, because they got really big hats.
So I think he might have taken it off.
Yeah, but then you're not a proper bishop.
So one of Edmund's sons, Edward, was still alive, and he'd fathered three children: a son, Edgar, and two daughters, Margaret and Christina, who were all at this point very small children. And the family was invited to England, presumably with the intention of Edward the Confessor naming Edward the Exile as his heir. And it's not clear whether or not the idea was Godwin or Edward's. It might be that Edward the Exile was sort of seen as a compromise candidate. Basically, a kind of, the Godwinsons wanted to repeat what they'd done with Edward the Confessor, where just find a guy who barely knows anything about England.
This guy's lived in Hungary his whole life.
This guy, well no, Edward the Exile, like, he probably spoke Hungarian, not English. He probably knew nothing about Hungary, knew nothing about England, probably didn't care about England. He was quite happy being a regional Hungarian nobleman. And then this bishop says, you must return to the lands in the west.
Come be a king. You'll have so much authority.
Pay no attention to the 15 earls with daggers who are all related to each other standing behind you.
All these Godwinsons.
Yeah. So, Edward the Exile says, fuck no. Absolutely not.
I'd rather eat this unseasoned goulash.
I'd rather eat this bread.
Yeah.
I like living in a country where the bread doesn't kill you. So, in 1057, he does return to England at last. And what do you think happens when he sets foot in England? Almost moments before he even meets with Edward the Confessor, what do you think happens to him?
He dies.
If I am to be a puppet king, may this crust of bread strike me down.
So Edward the Exile died, but his children now are living in England. And so now you have male member of the House of Wessex who could conceivably succeed Edward the Confessor as King of England. And that's why the son Edgar, son of Edward the Exile, starts getting referred to as Edgar Aethling, which means essentially crown eligible prince. A lot of people make a big deal out of the whole, oh, he was called Aethling, that means he was named heir. That's not what it actually means. It just means he was eligible to be the king. And there is some evidence that, like, Edgar was considered as a candidate for an heir, despite the fact that he's, again, a small child in the 1050s. So he was recorded in the Liber Vitae of Winchester Cathedral as a prince, and his name was placed where we would expect a royal son to appear, basically after Edward and Edith's names. But Edward, if he did intend for Edgar to succeed him, Edward never really made a serious attempt to, like, advance him, to give him lands or titles. He just, like, have this. I think, to be honest, it was just useful to have this kid around as a, like, threat, essentially. to the Godwinsons.
Watch out, I have a small Hungarian child.
His language isn't even Indo-European. Yeah. It's a different thing. It's like a linguistic isolate.
It's like Mongolian, maybe? We don't know. It might be Finnish.
But yeah. I mean, yeah, because he's now, you know, just because Godwin's dead doesn't mean that, like, you know, Edward's troubles are gone. Because he's got the, like, four or five sons of Godwin to deal with. And they're all, like, they're all horrible little men. And,
they're
each
dreadful.
Of their way, each in their own way. I mean, you've got Swain, who's the oldest one, who unfortunately, like, will not live to see the end of this story. Because around this time, he's, like, taking himself out in spectacular fashion.
This bread looks delicious.
He abducts, like, an abbess to try to, like, claim her lands. He's like, if we get married, then all of her land will be mine, so we'll just fucking go abduct her. And everyone is like, what the fuck? Even his own, like, family are like, what the hell, man? Like, that's not cool. And his brother... Oh, yeah, there are, like, five of them, because then their other brother, Bjorn, is like, man, like, can we talk this over? And Swain is like, sure. Goes to the meeting and just kills Bjorn.
It's a very Coen Brothers-esque sort of, like,
oh, no,
band.
I think
the
he also...
The Godwinsons are Coen Brothers' character.
He also runs away to Flanders, I think, at this point. He, like, waits for things to blow over, and, like, they kind of do and they kind of don't, and he ends up going on a pilgrimage, like, to the Holy Land to repent and just die. On the way back.
Guys, which, I'm really sorry.
Which will definitely not happen again in this story.
No, definitely. Definitely not. But yeah, and then, I mean, so yeah, you've got him. I mean, okay, so he's... Because, you know, just because Godwin is dead doesn't mean that, you know, Edward's problems have decreased at all, because Godwin has a lot of kids. he, I think, has at least, like, what is it, like... I think, like, 11 kids, which is so scary, you know? So, him dying is, like, the head on the Hydra has been cut off. Like, there's more of them. But the most important ones, I would say, there are his oldest son, Swain. And then we've got Harold, Edith, his daughter, we've talked about already. Tostig, he has a son named Girth, actually, which I really like.
That's his other son, Length.
Like, my seventh child. What am I going to call him?
We're out of all the good names.
All the classics have been used up.
Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly. But those are, and then there's a few more, but those are really the ones. Actually, you don't even really have to know Girth, but...
But it's fun.
But we like Girth.
We like... Girth is very important. A lot of people say he's more important than Length.
Oh my gosh, that's...
Well, first of all, Swain is not going to see out the end of this story, so he's the oldest one, but he also seems to be, like, a complete loose cannon. He seems to be, like, a bit of a mad lad, and,
legend.
Well, yeah, he is a bit of a legend, to be fair. While these events are going on, he abducts one of the abbesses of England, I think just basically to, like, seize her land.
He has a cunning money-making
he wants her
scheme.
He wants her tracts of land.
It could be described as a caper.
Yeah,
they're very Coen Brothers-esque, the Godwinsons.
No, exactly. Exactly. And everyone is like, what the fuck, man? Like, Edward is, but also his own family are like, mate, you can't do that.
He can't be kidnapping abbesses.
Yeah. And so he gets exiled, and he goes to Flanders, as these people often do. He goes to Denmark and seemingly gets expelled from Denmark and is like, okay, well, you know what? I may as well try to go back to England.
Goes to Denmark, is like, I've got a cunning plan to make money here, lads.
Yeah. No, exactly. And then... And then, so he actually manages to, like, you know, Edward is like, fine, like, we can talk it over. And so he, Swain, like, links up with his cousin Bjorn, and Bjorn is like, I'm gonna chaperone you to make sure nothing goes bad. So Swain murders Bjorn quickly and flees again. I forgot that was the order of events, actually. Yeah. It's really good. Because, yeah, he's been, like, exiled for, like, several years, and then he comes back and he's like, I've changed. I've reflected on my behavior.
And now it's time to kill an immediate member of my family.
Yeah.
For no discernible reason.
He's just
going
to chaperone me, you know, it'll be fine. As long as we don't get in a fight.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. So yeah, it's actually...
Hey, Bjorn, I bet you can't eat this French bread sideways.
Yeah, and actually when Godwin and all of his sons are exiled, Swain, that's when he leaves England and never comes back. And I think he has, like, the harshest sort of sentence. Edward says, like, specifically for Swain, like, it's on sight.
I can put up with you and your twink brother, yeah. But that Swain guy.
No, exactly. Exactly.
He's in Swain.
He's in Swain in the
Swain.
Swain
in the membrane.
Exactly.
He can't be trusted to be escorted. Yeah. We leave him around, Amethyst will be kidnapped.
Yeah.
He's going to get his chance on her tracts of land.
No, basically. And so I think he's like, okay, well, I went to Denmark, you know, for my first exile, so I better do something even more dramatic now. And he's like, I'm going to go on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And, like, I think he says he's going to walk all the way there on foot. And, like, the process just kills him.
It's a very Facebook-style meltdown. Like, but guys, I know I screwed up, but I'm trying to do better, okay? I'm raising money for charity.
Yeah.
I'm going to walk all the way on foot to Jerusalem.
Immediately
then you should walk, yeah. Falls into a ditch.
Oh yeah, it was a barefoot pilgrimage.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's just walking along the roads like, ow, ow, ow.
God, I wish I had some cousins to murder.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that basically leaves, leaves basically two Godwinson sons that we have to keep track of at this point, which are Harold, who after the kind of, after Godwin dies, becomes Earl of Wessex and sort of becomes head of the family.
Famously large-eyed.
Yes. And we'll get to some adjectives about him. His younger brother, Tostig. Now, the chronicler Odoric Vitalis later wrote of Harold that he was distinguished by his great size and strength of body, his polished manners, his firmness of mind and command of words, by a ready wit and a variety of excellent qualities. But what availed so many valuable gifts when good faith, the foundation of all virtues, was wanting? Which is a little bit of a backhanded compliment, I would say. And Harold's first kind of major act as Earl of Wessex, because he had been Earl of East Anglia briefly before, is to lead a massive invasion of Wales with the support of Tostig, who, again, as a reminder, was Earl of Northumbria at this point. So, for context, the Welsh prince of Gwynedd, Rhufudd ap Llywelyn, had been able to sort of establish rule over all the various sort of backbiting provinces of Wales and become the first ever proper king of the Welsh. And he'd done that with the help of a pivotal alliance with the Earl of Mercia, because again, the Earl of Mercia has been boxed in for the last couple of years by the advancing Godwinsons. He's like, okay, who can I work with? Oh God, Wales, I guess.
The court is increasingly looking like a Godwin family reunion.
Yeah, and so Gruffudd actually marries the sister of the Earl of Mercia, when that alliance falls apart, Gruffudd is no longer under Mercia's protection, and Harold basically figures that actually an overmighty Welsh king is a liability to have on the English frontier, so let's go in, kick some skulls, and see if we can splinter Wales into 100 different kingdoms again, because Welsh politics is generally just Rhys's killing each other. Rhys's falling to pieces.
Rhys's increasingly small pieces of land.
So Harold and Tostig lead an invasion of Wales that's so brutal that Gruffudd actually is betrayed and beheaded by his own men.
Goddamn.
And in exchange, the princes of Wales just agree to go back to splitting their kingdoms again.
Please leave us alone.
But there's a plot twist, which is that at some point between the death of Gruffudd and 1066, Harold then marries Gruffudd's widow. People keep stealing each other's wives in this story.
This is also weird because this is also like a second marriage, because he has like a common law wife.
Yes.
Who he's, like, not married to as well, Harold. So, yeah, he has, like, a lot of, he's got a lot of women in the pocket.
Yeah. Meanwhile, so that's Harold. Let's talk about Tostig. Because Tostig If you think Harold is a sort of a bit of a liability, Tostig is just an absolute disaster.
Well, Tostig, I think, to be fair, he's got the short end of the stick because he is made eventually Earl of Northumbria. Yes. And to me, like, Earl of Northumbria, different can of worms to being, like, Earl of Wessex.
I would like to run through some of the issues with being Earl of Northumbria. Job, point number one, your main job is keeping the North
under control. I was going to say, jocks.
Well, yes, no.
Geordies.
So the Scots.
Yeah,
so,
no, exactly.
So you've got two kingdoms on your northern frontier. So problem number one, Northumbria is probably the hardest English province to rule. It's the furthest from any of the sort of southern centers of power, and there's just a lot of banditry. Number two, you've got the Kingdom of Scotland to your immediate north, who love raiding, and so keeping the Scots out is a core part of the job. And number three, it's just the North has seen itself for a really long time as a kind of independent political community. And Tostig is from the South. He is the son of the Earl of Wessex.
I think you can think like he would have thought he could do a good job because, like, you know, his mum is like a Viking. Yes. And so you can see him as like kind of arriving.
And he has a Viking name.
Northumbria as like one of those Irish Americans who goes back to Ireland and is like, no, listen. Like,
oh my God, you guys, my great, 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 great grandfather was from Kerry.
But yeah, they don't seem to love him up there.
They immediately hate
him. He seems to have been like really passive on fighting with the Scots, but he's actually like mates with the Scottish king.
Yeah.
So he's like, he puts up like not that much resistance to like, you know, the raiding. So the king, like, I don't want to piss my friend off.
Guys.
Because the reason for that is that, so the King of Scots at this point is Malcolm III, Malcolm Canmore, also, which means Big Head, who is this sort of titanic character. He is Malcolm from Macbeth. So Macbeth has been happening off screen throughout this entire story. And of course, if anybody who knows Macbeth knows that Malcolm was placed on the Scottish throne with the support of Earl Seward, the previous Earl of Northumbria. And so he is seen as this guy who's going to be amenable to working with the English and understands what side his bread is buttered on. But what he does instead is immediately start raiding the north of England. He annexes Cumbria, probably, which had been this sort of perennial border region that had sort of switched hands back and forth between, at various points, the Brittonic Kingdom of Strathclyde, the Kingdom of Scots, and the Kingdom of the English. He then also, he just causes problems, and Tostig doesn't really do anything. He just sort of accepts it as a fait accompli. He isn't even in the north when this is happening.
Yeah, and he's also, like, I think, you know, he's really living in, like, the New Hampshire of England, yes, in a way, because they're also, like, very libertarian.
Yeah.
Like, the Danish sort of population, or the Danish-descended population, like, they're not really used to paying a lot of taxes or having, like, to encounter the long arm of the law that much.
Oh, no, they pay, like, 1/6 of the taxes of Wessex.
And so when Tostig is like, guys, like, we need to go to Wales to, like, keep you guys, or, like, you know, go to Scotland to, like, keep everyone from getting killed, they're like, well, isn't there a way to do that without raising any levies? Can't we just make it happen without spending any extra money?
Yeah.
And Tostig has to be like, no, guys, we need to spend extra money to buy swords and pay people. And all the Danes,
and everyone
like,
in Yorkshire is like,
we hate you soft southern boy.
And yeah. So
there's a budget cap, so you do need to solve these problems, but you can't raise taxes.
And also, we think you're effete and feminine and weak because you're not from here. Because
you're a Zoomer.
Yeah.
And yeah, and it's I think that Viking point is really important because at this point the North is so culturally distinct from the South of England. So many people there are, you know, are Danish speakers.
That's where the Danelaw was.
Yeah, exactly. It's, as we talked about in the previous episode, like, part of the process of English state formation was accepting that the North was different.
Yeah.
And the North would have to be able to govern itself, and with only a few exceptions, since Northumbria was absorbed into England, they have basically let the North govern itself. And now here's this, you know, southern twink coming along and telling them you need to raise fucking taxes.
Hey guys.
And so Tostig faces almost immediate political backlash from this, to which his response is, well, what if I just assassinate my political opponents?
Ah, the Godwin classic.
Yeah, so he just starts knocking off various sort of thanes and minor and
he's
sort
like,
of,
this is what my dad did.
Yeah. But it doesn't work because nobody respects him.
Yeah.
And so in 1065, there's an enormous revolt across Northumbria.
Oh my God, we hate you so much.
Yeah.
And he's not getting
a real Viking.
Yeah, exactly. No. He's like, no, I am a real Viking.
I've been doing so many assassinations.
Look, I can hold this axe.
Look, I have the horned helmet. And they're like, you idiot, we don't wear the horned helmets.
I really love a rotten fish, right, yeah. guys?
Right. No, no, you have to do it in a certain way. Yeah. It's fermented, not rotten. But yeah, and he's getting no help whatsoever from any of his family as well.
Well, again, to be fair, it's hard to get a campaign going. But there's this enormous revolt that starts in the city of York, where they just start slaughtering all of his kind of allies and demanding that essentially the brother of the Earl of Mercia becomes the new Earl of Northumbria, and that and Tostig is kicked out. And so Harold, Tostig's brother, is sent by Edward to kind of mediate between the rebels and Tostig. Because, by the way, while this is happening, Edward has started to get deathly ill. And he still has no heir, except for this sort of vague, this child who's kind of on the picture, kind of, but not really. And so he's not really able to exercise any kind of authority, despite the fact that almost half the kingdom is in revolt. And by the way, the Mercians have joined the Northumbrians now. So basically, the whole kingdom is on the verge of falling apart.
Ask me about the struggles of trying to do anything while ill.
No, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the reasons why Harold isn't much help as well is because he's been away traveling. He's wound up sort of sailing the seas. He's spent a bit of time, unwillingly, I should say, in Normandy, which we will get to.
In a future episode,
He's encountered people who we will discuss in future episodes.
And possibly made certain commitments that he shouldn't have.
Yeah.
And
one of the reasons why it's theorized that, I should say, he was traveling and maybe, talking to certain people or going to the continent was to try to, shore up his own alliances. So I think Harold has established himself as, the big dog.
Yeah.
And he is more interested in, seeing what he can get from this situation than he is in, helping his family out of a sense of, fraternal obligation.
Absolutely.
He's already been dealing with two fail sons. Failed brothers.
Yeah. He's so sick of his fail brothers at this point. I think,
yeah.
You can blame him.
So he rides north and meets with the kind of with the rebels and with Tostig, and eventually he just says, "Well, you know what? Actually, on behalf of the king, you can have a new earl." And Tostig
he's pissed.
He's ludicrously angry.
Yeah.
He feels completely betrayed, but essentially left for dead by his own brother, and he's not even exiled from the kingdom. He just leaves, spitting fucking daggers to Flanders.
Could you imagine getting the hardest job possible? The guy on the easy ride sort of swans over. He's like, oh, you're having trouble there?
Yeah.
Should I bail you out? No. Get fucked, dickhead.
And that's your brother.
Yeah. And but understandably, he's like, screw this, I'm going to Flanders.
Yeah. And so it seems like everything is quietened down, but as the year 1065 rolls into 1066, it's clear that England is not out of the woods yet, because Edward the Confessor's condition is getting worse and worse and worse, and it's becoming clear that he is nearing death.
He's looking increasingly pale and sickly. He's got a little halo floating over his head already.
His eyes are turning to crosses.
His soul keeps leaving his body and then getting dragged, pushed back in. Edward's failing health is of particular importance because of a certain William, Duke of Normandy, who has stated his interest in the English crown.
Yeah, he seems to have some sort of story that he's cooked up about how Edward has promised this crown to him at some point. Nobody knows, and we'll get more into it later in future episodes as well. But you can imagine the house of cards is beginning to fall or something. The dominoes have been set in motion. It's the king is dying. People are sort of rallying at the borders to try to take the English crown. And I think Harold realizes all of this land has to be governed by one guy.
Yeah.
If it's going to stand a chance of, surviving this whole process intact.
Guys, I don't think this Hungarian child is up to this task.
He's like, I don't think this Hungarian child is up to this task. And obviously my stupid brother Tostig isn't going to accomplish anything.
Yeah,
here.
Tostig is currently off in Flanders becoming Iago from Othello.
Yeah, he's just
hunched over, ranting in Flemish.
And Harold is this probably probably won't come back to bite me.
Yeah. So on the 5th of January, 1066, Edward the Confessor dies. So on the 5th of January, 10.
What's wait? I think someone's drilling. Yeah. Or taking I think they're moving out through there, so they might be like.
Oh right, yeah, taking things off.
Yeah.
So on the 5th of January, 10.
Okay, I'm gonna pause.
This is comedy.
This is quite funny.
There's some debate about what Edward the Confessor actually said on his deathbed. So later English sources will claim that he entrusted the kingdom to the care of Harold. But this is different versions of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle are sort of equivocal about this. There are different words used in place of entrusted that are vaguer. And what does entrusted mean? A lot of the interpretation hinges on the idea that maybe he was essentially... In fact, the thing that I think probably is the case is that I suspect he wanted Harold to be the regent for Edgar.
Yeah.
Where essentially Harold would rule on Edgar's behalf until Edgar came of age. Because Edgar's like 14 at this point.
Harold's not the assistant king, he's the assistant to the king.
Exactly. But whatever the case, this leaves domestic English politics in a huge... crisis, because that is just one interpretation of one version of the story. There's domestically huge amounts of uncertainty, and the problem is that not only is England slipping into potentially a massive political crisis, but there are wolves at the door. Because whilst all this has been happening, Tostig Godwinson has been establishing contacts and networks on the continent. And a few months after the death of Edward the Confessor, Tostig Godwinson travels to the court of one of the most remarkable characters in the entire European Middle Ages, a swashbuckling and slightly terrifying man called Harald Stiggerson, the King of Norway.
Huzzah! Ha-ha!
But we will have to meet Harald Sigurdsson, King of Norway, in a future episode. An episode that I am so thoroughly looking forward to. We're going to have a dragon. We're going to have empresses. People are getting poisoned. It's brilliant.
Yeah, proper Byzantine court politics.
Yeah. There's Sami shamans, like, creating magical artifacts, and also Byzantine court politics, and also a guy pretending to be dead so he can sneak into a town and kill everybody. It's incredible. It's the story of Harald Hardrada and the story of what has been happening in Scandinavia in the meantime is so integral to everything that's been happening from the first Viking raids onwards. So we will pick up the story with the Scandinavian perspective in the next episode.
None of this Nepo baby business.
Nah.
Ooh, I'm Godwin's son. I wonder how he got that job.
Yeah.
Guess what? There's a big man with an axe standing behind him are 500 other equally big men with even bigger axes.
They're really eager to see a bridge.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's where we will leave off for today. The King of England is dead. There's loads of other guys that are like, it's me. I'm the King of England now. How will the matter be settled? It's anyone's guess.
A rumbling of hurdy-gurdies in the north.
Exactly.
Alright, well that is just about going to do us for this episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. If you like this episode and if you like this podcast, please do leave us a 5-star review. If you leave us enough 5-star reviews, we might not go on a 5-month hiatus again. That's right, that was a threat. And if you also like the show, you can leave us a Spotify comment and Olivia might read it out.
What?
That was her Spotify noise.
Yep. What?
That was the noise I make when I tap directly into the Spotify API using my brain.
We plugged the data, the Neuralink into a data jack on the back of her neck.
I can see all the songs.
There's numbers scrolling over her eyes. Yeah. She's like, wow, these artists really don't make much money.
Yeah. The numbers are a lot of zeros.
Oh.
Pound sign zero.
Pound sign, yeah. 0 pennies.
Pound sign 0.03.
Mm.
As I'm binging this podcast in a scattered order, you can imagine my surprise when in one episode this archaeologist Joe Mason is stuck in a hole and another turned into a frog. Then I learn he is a very real person and a guest on the show. Brilliant. 10 out of 10. We'll keep listening.
This is what people don't understand about the podcast, is it is an ongoing narrative.
Yeah. Also, I'm not real.
This is just me doing a voice.
Yeah, it's true. Like, anytime you talk over each other, it's just poor editing.
Olivia's accidentally overlaid two tracks on each other. Like, she's doing it now.
Who'd be an archaeologist? It's a stupid job.
Yeah. Let me make sure I get a clean bit of me doing Joe's laughter.
I'm a real boy.
See? All right. Until next time, take it easy.